We're doing the book of Esther, after having learned the first six chapters of the book of Daniel. What we know is that the Babylonian Empire destroyed the first temple, and Nebuchadnezzar, who is a midget, he's one arm tall, 22 inches tall, has, with much cruelty, taken into captivity the Judean king Zedekiah, slaughtered his children opposite his eyes, gorged out his eyes, and taken him into captivity and suffering into Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar takes the Jews into captivity and slavery. And after Nebuchadnezzar passes away, we have his son Evil-Merodach is king for 23 years, and then Belshazzar for 3 years. And we know that Nebuchadnezzar's dream, with interpretation, brings into the world a new element of competition and threat, with the world sensing that if the Messiah is coming, then there's a threat to everyone, because the Jews will ultimately take back the throne, so the Jews are perceived as a threat. It might take a millennium or two, but the threat is nonetheless sensed as being imminent. And so even though Koresh, the kind king, permits the Jews to go back and rebuild the second temple, he then receives a letter from Haman's son Shimshi, among others, that the Jews will rebel against him if he permits them to continue building the temple. And he stops the building of the temple. And then when Ahasuerus comes to the throne, Ahasuerus, who used to be a stable boy under the Babylonian king Belshazzar, and then he forms a relationship with Belshazzar's daughter Vashti, so that when the Persians and Medes take over the throne, Ahasuerus marries Vashti, and Ahasuerus is now viewed as royalty because he is married to royal blood. And in those days, royal blood was considered different. It didn't matter if you were the victor or the captor. Even when they'd capture kings, they gave them royal treatment because they were royalty. And royalty. The exception was Nebuchadnezzar. But you see, when he died, his son did give Zedekiah royal treatment. Nebuchadnezzar was the exception. He was cruel to everyone. But it was a sign of power. The idea of giving royal treatment was, it was like the Geneva Conventions. I'll treat you humanly, you'll treat me humanely. This way, we all have a certain assurance that whatever happens, there's a certain basic humane treatment. Nebuchadnezzar basically said, like ISIS, I got nothing to lose. I'm going to win. And so I'm saying that's what Nebuchadnezzar said. So when he would capture kings, he'd torture them to death. He didn't care. He said, I'm not losing. I'm going to win. And he did. He conquered the world. So Nebuchadnezzar was the one king who did not give royal treatment. Now Ahasuerus, once he's married Vashti, royal blood, so now he's considered royal quality. And using his wealth, he goes up to the throne. Now there is two approaches to the Megillah. One approach says that Ahasuerus was a fool. And the other approach says that Ahasuerus was very, very smart. The Talmud tells us that when Esther wanted to write down Megillat Esther, so the rabbi said to her, you're going to arouse enmity. The nations will hate us for this. You can't do that. And so what we're being told, in other words, so I heard from Rabbi Beryl Wein, is that the book of Esther had to be written behester, just like her name, with a certain element of cloak. You had to hide what the real message was. So if the book is being written while Ahasuerus is king, as we find it was, and the book is going to be examined by the non-Jews as we find it was, the Talmud says that the sages said to Esther, the nations will be very upset at us if we start celebrating Purim. So you see, the nations knew what was going on here. Esther sends the book of Esther throughout the land, so chances are other people saw it too. So the book has to be written with a certain element of secrecy. where you have to look between the lines to understand what's going on. And our sages had two approaches to Achashverosh. Was Achashverosh very smart, or was Achashverosh very dumb? And sometimes it's hard to tell. Sometimes you can read into what someone does and see genius in it, and sometimes you're just reading into it because he's really stupid. There's an old joke about a chassid who never learned anything and he didn't know what to do or what to say. So he was going to meet his future father-in-law and he went to his best friend and said, he's going to test me in my learning, so what should I do? So the guy says, look, there are two words you need to know. You know this? Punkt verkehrt, which means the exact opposite. When he sits down to learn, you tell him, you explain it. And when he says something, so he looks at you to hear what you have to say, you just say, punkt verkehrt, the exact opposite. So the guy comes, he sits down with the potential future father-in-law, he says, let's learn something, he wants to test the son-in-law, says, bechavot, he starts reading a line in Talmud, he reads a line in Rashi, he says, so Rashi seems to be telling us, and he tells him a whole thought, and the guy goes, punkt verkehrt. So he says, really? He starts rereading Rashi, thinking about it. He thinks. After a few minutes, he says, you know what? That's genius. You're right. You're right. Rashi was saying the exact opposite. Wow. He keeps reading, and the same story happens a second time and a third time. And after the third time, he looks at him and says, I got to tell you, he tells him in Lamdish terms, he says, you're a serious Lamdin. So the guy didn't understand what he was being told. So he looks at him and says, Punkt verkehrt. So that's but if you look at the story of Esther, so if you look closely enough, you can see genius in what Achshverosh is doing, and our sages had two opinions as to whether you should interpret his actions that way or not. So those are two points to bear in mind in our story. Let's begin. So Achshverosh has a complex. He wants the world to value him by his own merits. He does not want to always be viewed as Vashti's husband. And so he shifts the capital. He makes the capital in Shushan. He thinks he's doing that because he wants to show everyone how he has this royal throne. Now, he wanted to replicate Solomon's royal throne. Solomon had a throne which no one could ascend. The way it was built was that if you'd place your foot on one step, so then the steps would start moving. The steps had shapes of hands of different animals, and there was a mechanism built into the chair that when you put your weight on one hand, so then that would start shifting things, and the bottom hand would lift your bottom foot and lift that up, and then it would lift your next foot to the next hand, and the animals would pass the king up. It would look like he was being passed from animal to animal all the way up to the throne. So Pharaoh, when Shlomo died, so Pharaoh came in and decided he's taking all of that. His daughter was married to Shlomo, and he came in and took Shlomo's throne, and he took a lot of other things. And then there was a Pharaoh down the road who decided he would ascend the throne, but he didn't know how. So he put one leg down on one animal, his hands, and the other leg came to take down to pick up his other leg. He didn't know how to work the thing, so it crippled him. He got such a whack from the mechanism that he was crippled for the rest of his life.
It wasn't like a metaphysical thing.
The Targum seems to say that it was mechanics. It was like gears. There was genius in the way it worked. That the weight could actually cause all these maneuvers to happen. But at the end of the day, the Targum seems to say it was mechanics. So he was crippled for the rest of his life. He was known as Paro Necho, Paro the Cripple. So Achashverosh learned his lesson. He wasn't about to try ascending the throne. But throughout the period of the Second Temple, so in Egypt and Alexandria, they were known that they had excellent scientists. And so he summoned the engineers and the scientists of Alexandria, and he asked them, can you build me a replica of this throne? And they said, yes, here are the raw materials we'll need, and it'll take us 3 years. And so they built it, and at the end of 3 years, they've been building it in Shushan, And at the end of 3 years, he comes in, and it's nothing like Shlomo's throne. They couldn't come close. The gold wasn't as beautiful. The mechanisms wouldn't work. Nothing was right about it. But it was still awesome. It just paled by comparison to Solomon's throne. And then he said to them, okay, now let's transfer it to the capital. And they said, no, it'll fall apart if we try to transfer it. Solomon's throne went from Jerusalem to Egypt to Persia. But this throne, if you transfer it, it'll crack, it'll go. So Ahasuerus says, okay. So he demolishes a bunch of buildings all around. So he appoints Shushan to be the capital, no problem. He shifts the capital. Now, intrinsic to that move was also a sign of greatness. I'll build my castle where I want. I don't have to have the capital that used to be the capital in this part of the world. I build it in Shushan. So he built his capital in Shushan. Our sages say that this is all Hashem's doing. Just like we have to look at the whole book of Esther as secretly showing us how Hashem is running the show. Ahasuerus is going to make a party. Ahasuerus is going to make a decree against the Jews. There is one Jew who has to enter the political world, and he's not there yet. His name is Mordechai. Where does he live? In Shushan. So Hashem had it that everything else worked out wrong for Ahasuerus, so that Ahasuerus would be forced to move his capital to Shushan, so that when the story plays itself out, all the constellations were in place. Everything was set so that Mordechai could come up and save the day. So the Megillah begins with, it was in the days of Ahasuerus, who ruled over all these countries, when he established his throne in Shushan, the capital. So the Megillah doesn't tell you this whole story. Our tradition tells us this whole story. That this was all set up, and Shushan was reestablished as the new capital after he was king for 3 years. What took him 3 years? Because he finished his throne. So now he could throw a party, and he could show everyone, look, the Jews are finished, they're done for. You thought no one could sit on Solomon's throne, look at me. What was the game? He was sitting on top when everyone walked in. If he would try to ascend the throne in front of everyone, so then they'd say, hey, we heard that throne has gears, everything moves. We didn't see that. So what Ahasuerus does is he's sitting on the throne, and everyone walks into the party. Now, you have to understand, the throne had a platform on the throne when Solomon would sit down. So he had magnets that would bring an eagle down and lift the crown off his head. And then the crown would stay hovering above his head. So when you'd come to see Solomon, you'd see a crown hovering above his head. He wouldn't have the weight of this tremendous gold crown on his head. It was hovering above his head. He had a platform of gold with gold seats so that the 70 Sanhedrin could be up there with him on the throne. So it wasn't just a seat, you know, with nice steps leading up to it. It had other steps that led up for the Sanhedrin. It had a huge platform up on top, and he had the elders up there. It had a seat for the queen. It had a seat for his great-great-great-grandmother, Ruth, who is still alive. He had a special seat for her next to him. It was very well thought out. I'm skipping. There are pages and pages. There are whole midrashim describing that throne. So, okay, this is the story in a nutshell. So,
Don't they mind magnets in general nowadays? Aren't magnets mined?
I don't know. I don't know. But the Talmud speaks about magnets, so they had magnets. So he brings in the army together with the top leaders, and he sits them all at the same table. So imagine you have the chief of staff, prime minister, second in command, everyone sitting at the same table with the lowest soldier, and they're all sitting around. What's the message? You're all the same to me. I'm the king, and you're all my workers. Now, he's going to make a party for 180 days. All winter long, they're going to be in his party. 6 months. What's the message? Nothing you do is important. I'm the king, and what's important is you're partying with me now. So he had a lot of wealth to show them. Every day he'd show them new wealth. And one opinion is that it wasn't even his own wealth. he would show them the wealth of his different officers. And he was basically saying, you can only imagine what I have. I'm not showing you what I have, but I'll show you the wealth of my different officers. So he finishes this whole party, and then he makes a party for the capital. So what was the logic in this? One opinion among our sages is that this was pretty dumb, because you always have to ensure that your capital is going to side with you. What are you making a party for everyone else for? First, make a party for the capital. Make sure that if there's a rebellion, your core people who are with you, they're with you. Make them happy. Afterwards, make a party for everyone else. That's what the opinion that he was pretty dumb. The other opinion says, no, the people in the capital, he could always give them gifts. It's very easy to make them happy because he's local. He knows their needs. He knows how to make them happy. That's easy. The difficult thing in a kingdom is to make the people happy far away. So the first thing he had to do was bring all of them in, spend time with them, understand them, make them happy, see that they should walk away feeling like he cares for them. And then he could worry about the people that are local, because that's easy. So he makes this party in Shushan. And we have this description. And in that final party in Shushan, after the six-month-long party, he changes some rules. In Persia, they had a custom that they'd bring out this huge mug, and they'd fill it up, and then you'd have to finish it. They'd put it before you, and you had to finish it. He made a rule. In my party, everyone does what they want. No forcing anyone. Everyone that walked into that final seven-day party, they'd ask him his age, and then they'd bring him a wine that was older than he was. Achashverosh was showing them something. Every day, they would use vessels different than the day before. He's showing them something. Now, yeah, I don't have to use the same vessel twice. And he summons in Mordechai, and he says, I want you to tell me which food the Jews can eat. I want you to arrange that the food here will be good and kosher for the Jews as well. And so Mordechai has no choice. He works with arranging kosher food for the party. And then he goes back to town, and he summons all the Jews, and he says, you're not allowed to go to that party.
Why?
This is a party that's supposed to unite everyone, and you have no right to unite. They're going to try to bring you to intermarry. They're going to, you know, it's like they say sometimes, the kashrus is on the food, but not on the content of entertainment. So Mordechai says, you're not allowed to go to that party. You're not allowed to enjoy what Achashverosh is doing. Well, the Jews don't listen, and they go. And what they don't realize now, Vashti had a wicked custom. She went in the ways of her father and grandfather. She hated the Jews. And every Shabbos, she would bring in Jewish girls and force them to work in places that were visible to the public and force them to work without clothing. And she had it in to show, to ensure that they would not live up to the beauty of a Jewish woman, the modesty of a Jewish woman. So they make a party, and she also has her party. And the idea, their original plan was, we'll start the party modest, everyone will drink, and after 7 days, everyone will be all drunk up, we'll take down the doors, and we'll start having men and women mixing, and then we'll have everything, all the promiscuity we can desire. So, on the seventh day, Achashverosh has drunk a lot, and he summons his seven eunuchs, and he tells them, go tell Vashti, my queen, that the king wants to see her, and she shouldn't forget to bring that crown. I want to show the world what a beauty she is. Now, what happened here was, our sages say, if you sit down at a Jewish party, what should happen is that as people are eating and drinking, they talk Divrei Torah, they talk words of Torah. If they're not learned, they're not talking words of Torah, they should sing songs that reflect the praise of Hashem. What do we sing? What songs do we sing? Ashram Shekachalo, Baruch Elokeinu Shebranu Lichvodo, blessed is our Creator who created us in His honor. What songs do we sing? We sing V'tein B'libeinu Bina L'Havenu L'Haskil, give us understanding to understand your Torah. Our songs reflect our desire to be good people. What happens when a person who doesn't have Torah starts drinking? So he starts talking about women. So it says the conversation went like this. The nobles would start talking, and we will see later on in the Megillah that every noble knew the good-looking women in his town. And so each one started saying about how beautiful the women in his locale are. And they're all comparing notes until Achashverosh turns to them and says, the vessel I use, notice how he calls his wife, The vessel I use is not like any of your vessels. Mine is different than anything you've ever seen before. She's not Persian. She's not Mede. So they say, really? Where's she from? He says, oh, she's from the Babylonians, from the Kasdim. She's different than all of yours. So they say, really? He says, yeah, more beautiful than any of yours. So they say, let's see. So he says, I'll show you. They say, no, we want to really see. So he says, I'll really show you. And he sends word to Vashti, and he tells her, come with the crown and the crown alone. Now, he's telling her two things. One thing he's telling her is to come with wearing only a crown. The second thing he's telling her is, don't forget to bring that crown. So he's putting her down. She is a princess, and he is the knave, the guy who used to take care of the horses, the stable boy. And he sends her this word. He sends the seven eunuchs to summon her, to bring her in like she was a maid, and remind her to bring her crown. So Vashti says, I'm queen before he's king, and I'm not coming with his summon. Our sages say that, in fact, she wanted to come in. She was interested in breaching the fences of modesty. She was interested in coming in and showing off her beauty. She was as interested as he was. But she started breaking out. So she put on a little bit of eyeshadow and mascara and tried to cover up this blemish and that blemish, and it kept getting worse. Everything she'd cover up, she'd see something else pop out. And say, our sages go so far as to say she grew a tail. She sends back, what, you're summoning me? My dad, on that night of the great battle, drank 1,000 cups of wine and didn't go drunk. You, stable boy, you've been drinking for 7 days and already you're drunk. You're going to summon me? So Ahasuerus is very upset. And he's upset internally also, because his whole plan was to show everyone, I'm king, I don't need her. Look, I married her for her beauty, but I'm king by my own rights. And look, she turned the tables on him. Now, he was concerned that if this was given over to the Persian courts, they'll say she needs to get killed, and he doesn't want to kill her. So he's not sure what to do. So he says to the wise men, he says, you know, I think that this has to be given over to a different court. People who know the law, you guys know how to gauge the times. And if you gauge the times, so technically she just embarrassed me at a pivotal time where everyone was present. But let me give it to the people who know the laws of Persia and Mede. Now, his lowest advisor was Memuchan. So everyone knows the Medrash that Memuchan is Haman, and that Memuchan was Haman, and he was the fool. He spoke first. But there's an alternate Medrash that says that Memuchan was
Daniel.
And Daniel had a difficult wife who wouldn't talk to him Hebrew. And Daniel wanted to talk Hebrew. Our sages say that when you talk Hebrew, it affects you, it affects your family, it affects your kids. You have to try and talk Hebrew in your home, and your children have to have their first language as Hebrew. So the trusted advisor, the one who was really the top advisor, was Memuchan Daniel. And Daniel seized the opportunity to win his wife. So he says, you know, what's happened here is a danger to everyone. Because when the women hear what happened here, they're all going to say, hey, the queen could tell the king what she wants, and she does what she wants. She doesn't have to listen to him. So then all the men are going to have trouble. Now, what do we see? What just went on here? Daniel revealed what's really going on in everyone's house. Meaning, everyone thinks, I'm going to tell my wife what to do, and I'm going to be the big boss, and it doesn't work that way. Suddenly a person gets married, and you know the line, I have the final word in this house. Yes, dear? Right? There's at the end of the day, there's a tremendous frustration that men suddenly discover within their marriage that they don't run the house. They'd like to run the house. They imagine they run the house. Even Ahasuerus couldn't run his palace. So Daniel says, what's going to happen here? Women are all going to turn on their husbands, and they're going to say, King Ahasuerus said to bring Vashti, and she didn't come. So now I'm supposed to do what you want? So there's going to be a lot of anger here. The nobles are going to go back home. They're not going to be smart enough not to tell the story over. On the contrary, everyone's going to come home and say, you know what happened at the palace? The king summoned Vashti, and she said no. So you know what? You have to put out a decree that because Vashti didn't come, the throne will be given to someone else, someone better than her. Better than her. You know what a good wife is? A good wife is you tell her to come, she's going to come. So then you'll give out the word, and then everyone will hear, and then all the wives will know to honor their husbands, and it doesn't matter any husband, it doesn't matter if he's the lowest farmer. It's important to him that his wife honors him. I'll tell you a little game I invented, and I've been getting tremendous feedback from it, that couples should make up for 1 week, that every time she begins a sentence, she says to him, "You are amazing." And look at that, he will be so happy. He knows that you're just saying that. Start every sentence with, "You are amazing, you are phenomenal. I'm so lucky you're my husband." Now, even though it's a game, you know you're supposed to say it. He has to begin every sentence with, "I adore you. I'm so happy you're my wife."
For a week?
For 1 week. Every sentence you begin with a word that reflects that you adore her, and every sentence that she says has to begin with a sentence that reflects that you are amazing. And couples have told me it was the best week of their life. You'd be surprised. You know it's a game, right? But everyone wants to hear it. So Mordechai says to the king, he says, even the lowest farmer, I'm sorry, Memuchan says to the king, everyone wants their wife to value them. That's what it says in Josephus, that one time the king was sleeping and the advisors had a contest, who's going to be smartest? So they said, we'll make a contest and the king will decide in the end. So they said, okay, our challenging question is, what's the most powerful thing in the world? So each one gave a different answer. And then Daniel said, the most powerful is the woman. So each one explained their answer. And then Daniel said, look, even the king, one of them tried to say the king is the most powerful thing in the world. Because look at the king. He's conquered so many kingdoms and no one could stand up to him. So Daniel said, yeah, but even the king, after he finishes his war, what does he do? He brings back all the loot, spreads it out before the queen, and waits to hear her say, "Ooh, and ah, and wow, you're amazing." So you see, even by the great king, the queen's word carries a tremendous weight. And if she doesn't say that, he feels bad. And everyone agreed Daniel's answer was right. And then Daniel said, but that's wrong too. The truth is Hashem is the most powerful. And then he went on to explain to them that there is Hashem.
I said.
Okay. According to the understanding that Memuchan is Daniel, he's telling him, you want peace in your kingdom, then things have to go out that way. The law that goes out is that every man is boss in his house, and the spoken language in the house is your nationality's language, which is what Daniel wanted to achieve. It was important to him that in his house they speak Hebrew. So that's that understanding. The more known understanding, the more well-known understanding is that this was a foolish thing. It was because they were all drunk. So they come out with the law. And when this law went out, so people looked at it and said, if my wife talks back to me, I smack her in the face. Remember, you're not talking about Jews here. You're talking about the common farmer. The Talmud says even the common farmer Jew, they had problems of abuse. And the Talmud says that's why you weren't allowed to enjoy a wedding, to partake of a wedding where someone's daughter married someone not learned, because you had to worry that he might abuse her, he might hit her. So the Talmud says that you how can you partake of such a simcha? What are you rejoicing? You're putting her in a lion's den and you're rejoicing. In those days, they got this letter and they said, of course I'm boss in my house. My wife doesn't dare talk back to me. King's going to tell me to be boss in my house. So they looked at it and they said, this king's a fool. Okay, so Vashti, it doesn't say what happened to her. Notice how the Megillah covers that up. So the simple reading is, she was demoted, bye-bye Vashti, leave the palace. She became a maid somewhere, right? Our sages say she was hung. Yeah, that's what our sages say. She was hung, but the Megillah doesn't say it overtly. Perhaps it wasn't too honorable to Achashverosh, because you see, right afterwards it says that Achashverosh remembered Vashti, and he was pretty upset. You know, when he calmed down, he was upset. He missed Vashti. Now, our sages say Vashti was one of the more beautiful women that ever lived on the planet. So the king doesn't have his regular advisors because they're scared to come near the king. One opinion says that he actually killed them. The other says they went into hiding. They didn't want to come in because he'd ask them what happened and they'd have to confess. And then he'd say, I was drunk. Why'd you give me such bad advice? That's why our sages say that he went to the wise men of Israel. And the wise men of Israel sat and convened and they said, technically, he should execute her. Practically, tomorrow he'll be sober and he'll be upset he executed her. So they said to him, gee, ever since we've been exiled, we don't know how to give good advice. Go to a nation that hasn't been under such turmoil. Ask someone else. they backed out.
What did he ask them, what did he ask them first?
Why did he ask them first? I don't know. So they tell Achashverosh, set up policemen to gather every beautiful virgin girl into your harem. And then you'll give them all these different ointments to prepare themselves to find a new queen. So what happens next? Every man that has a modicum of intelligence takes his daughter and hides her. Because everyone knew that there'd only be one queen. The previous queen was executed after the king asked her something completely unreasonable. And after the king is going to sleep with every girl here, he's going to put her in his harem, and she's stuck for life in that harem. So anyone who had a modicum of intelligence and cared for his daughter took her and hid her. So the king had to set up a KGB to go and figure out where all these girls were, because he did it this way, again, indicating he wasn't too bright. And we'll pick up here, Ms. Hachim, tomorrow.